Hi, folks. Welcome. So I arrived early at a 2 week 2 week retreat in Santa Barbara, and is I don't know 10 or 15 years ago, and I'm a yogi, and I see a friend, longtime friend, somebody I've sat with a lot for months, and she's there early too, and we kind of lock eyes, in a friendly way. And you know what somebody would be doing there early at a retreat, right? They'd be looking for the best spot, right? Like we had this look like gold prospectors, kind of like and we sort of catch each other's eye, and we know we're both like, kind of plotting our best spots, in the meditation hall. And I said to her something like, we'll start letting go after we cling. And she's like, exactly. Yeah. So freedom is very closely linked to non-clinging in this tradition, but it's often that we try to essentially cling our way to freedom, yeah? Like us there early, scoping out the spots. And so the question is, how do we practice freedom? How do we practice freely on this path, this road of freedom? In other words, how do we build that the road of which Gil spoke yesterday without feeling weighed down by the labor involved? How do we build as freely as we can, knowing, of course, our heart is not purified of suffering? This Dharma practice is, it's about doing something new. Right? It's about doing something new, about living in a new way. But we can't start all at once. Right? We can't just stop the streams of karma flowing, meaning all the energies of habit from flowing into our life. And it's a real question, like, how does one do anything new? What would novelty actually be? This is, in a way, what we're seeking in our Dharma path. There's a saying, how you, I think it's from a Zen tradition, how you do anything is how you do everything, right? How you do anything is how you do everything. And yeah, each action, each little project, each thing we do is a microcosm, and often expresses a lot more about the energies of body and mind, the habits that we have. And so when we start practicing, we start to see how we live, That's part of the point of practice. We start to see how we live. Like, okay, this is how I wash dishes. This is how I grieve. This is how I love. This is how I practice. This is how I build my road. We get to see how we do all of this, and that's a revelation. And our habits, these habits, they have a lot of momentum. Maybe especially some of the habits that get us into trouble. In a way, it's like neurosis is often the path of least resistance, right? To glide down the path of neurosis takes no energy at all. It's just like gravity, right? And some aspects of the path require us to take a certain stand against that gravitational pull of some of our habits. It's meaningful to me that one of the kind of honorific, I think, nicknames for the Buddha was the unexcelled trainer of the animal within the human. The unexcelled trainer of the animal within the human. So when we enter the meditation hall, the Zoom hall, the IRC hall, we can't check our habits at the door. There's no suspension of the different streams of momentum. And so naturally, we can't help but reiterate our clinging. Yeah. That the way we practice in some ways is going to be a re-expression of how we cling. Our road building is going to reflect our conditioning, our past. And we want to be conscious of this, because how we start to do things in a new way is through awareness. And so we want to think about all the things we bring to practice, all the ideas and assumptions, the weight of the past. And it's like, oh, they're too numerous to even name. We start to become aware to catalog all the ways we structure the moment, all the ways we impose a certain form on the road building. Sayadaw Tejaniya says, you are not meditating. It's the ideas operating in the background, in the mind, that are meditating. Yeah. Then the meditating mind needs to be a Dhamma mind, yeah, a mind of wholesomeness. So we consider that, okay, you are not meditating. It's the ideas operating in the background that are meditating. And so we want to be cautious, careful around the kind of ideas in the background, that structure, that are in a sense doing the meditation. That is part of why when I find myself giving instructions, I'm often kind of pointing to seeding the mind with ideas that are conducive to the meditative unfolding. And that's a little different than the kind of technique, the concrete technique. So many ideas in the background. And yeah, we want to be bringing wisdom into the technique, wisdom into the craft of building the road. And we don't have to get this perfect. Indeed, we cannot, we will not get it perfect, right? There will be clinging involved, right? There's no way to have perfectly, you know, enlightened motivations. And our delusion, it thaws slowly, like a big block of ice or something frozen. It thaws slowly. And we have to be patient with that thawing process. Yesterday, Gil said something like, we hold all the ways we're not free with an open hand. Yeah. And I thought of, there's this very, I don't know, I've been always touched by it, this image at the end of this very dense philosophical text by a philosopher, Wittgenstein. And the argument he's making is to suggest that all the arguments he's made were, you kind of have to, if you understand them, you have to put them aside. Yeah, I'll share the quote. He says, anyone who understands me eventually recognizes my words as nonsensical when he's used them as steps to climb beyond them. He must, so to speak, throw away the ladder after he has climbed up it. He must transcend these propositions, these words, and then they will see the world aright. Yeah. And so that fits into a whole other philosophical thing, but I thought of it because clinging is a little bit like that. We don't want to try to cling our way to freedom, but some clinging will happen, and that's okay. We use some of that clinging, some of the striving, some of the ways the hand tightens into the fist in our practice. We use that like the ladder we climb and then toss aside. We don't have to get this perfect. We can't. Miles Davis said, if you're not making a mistake, it's a mistake. Yeah. We, in our own time, in our own way, we purify our intention for practice. We practice, we build from a wider, from a wiser place. And so the question, what supports practicing freedom on this path of freedom? What motivations, intentions, attitudes of mind support us to freely build our road? So we can we can distinguish between intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. Extrinsic motivation is something that we do for a particular outcome or reward. And intrinsic motivation is an activity we're doing for its inherent satisfaction. The reward, in other words, is in the doing. It's here and now. And so the question is Dharma practice, is it intrinsically or extrinsically motivated? Or both? On the one hand, we definitely practice for all kinds of outcomes, right? For rewards, for that which is not here now, to develop balance, to reduce anxiety, to grow our hearts, our ethical sensitivity, to perfect our sila, to enhance our equanimity, to let go more and more deeply, to be free, to know ease. We practice for all of these outcomes. And this is a kind of extrinsic motivation. But at the same time, this path is very much about intrinsic motivation. The way the heart is fed, is satiated right now. It's not in this sense about an outcome or the future. And what we see is that when we struggle to create an outcome, to when we get into the kind of scramble of building the road and looking far ahead, we wind up trying to kind of manipulate experience. And rather than just find the blessings of awareness in this moment, we try to control experience to engineer our path. And sometimes you hear the saying, like, the path is the goal. The path is the goal, right? And in this sense, this way of framing practice, we're not going anywhere. There's no traveling to somewhere. There's nowhere to get. There are a lot of ways of understanding that kind of language, but part of how I hear it is it's to really deeply honor and celebrate intrinsic motivation, the reward that's here and now, the kind of energy we marshal not to get somewhere, but to rest. And I feel that part of how we practice freely on this path of liberation is to find the kind of the seed of intrinsic motivation in us. Like, what the question is, like, okay, what is actually being fulfilled right now? What is being satiated right now? What motivation is, like, do I not need to be convinced of at all, because there's something being nourished? And then we just follow that thread. We follow that thread. Practicing freely is it's supported by an attitude of humility. Humility is something like a kind of balance point between arrogance and self-harshness, right? In humility is different than humiliation, right? Being humbled is different than being humiliated. In humility, we're not at all dismissive of ourselves. There's a lot of tenderness and care for ourselves and humility, but we're also not falling prey to delusions of specialness, right? The ego it's a kind of specialness, and practice makes us feel more and more ordinary. We really can spend our whole life mesmerized by the kind of shell games of ego, of arrogance, which inevitably brings into being self-hatred. And this humility is a kind of way of stepping out of the whole game. There's another component of humility, which is something like a recognition, a deep recognition of the contributions of others. As we start to feel less special, what we start to see is the beauty and the offering of others. And so right now, it's like we stand on the shoulders of the Buddha. An element of humility is this kind of like a reverence and devotion and an honoring of this whole lineage of wisdom and compassion. And this kind of, this skillful attitude of mind, this humility is necessary for us to do something that we have to do at some point on this path, which is to surrender. Many of the wonders of this path necessitate a deep surrender. The path at some point will bring us to our knees. The ego is all out of moves, and the heart has to let go in a new way. This is very humbling. This leaves absolutely no room for specialness. This is highly corrosive for all the strands of arrogance in our minds. Ajahn Sajito says, The point of deep learning is to go to the edge of what we know and where we control. There, the nobility of our life, the nobility of our purpose, the aspiration of life says, keep going past the area when you cannot control anymore, and trust. And that, for me, is the heart of devotion. This is not a surrender of responsibility, but a profound recognition of what the responsibility of our being is: to live in accordance with truth, to honor truth, and to trust the truth of our life as it is. I was a couple of weeks ago teaching with Wes Nisker, and And Wes is somebody who I would say like very, very closely associates the Dharma with awe, A-W-E, awe, the sense of awe. And he read a description of the an astronaut, you know, from I don't know where, but from far out, gazing back at our Earth, you know, from space, and the kind of impact that that makes on the mind, even just hearing the words decades later. And so I've been thinking about awe and its relation to practice and the way that it functions as a kind of helpful attitude to practice freely, awe, that sense of wonder at being in the presence of something vast, something that transcends us, something that is impenetrable to our understanding. There's something about gazing back at the Earth from 100,000 miles or what, 200,000 miles. Like, wow, what does that do to the mind? A kind of awe of that. And in that gaze into the vastness, you become very small. You become very small. But not in a way that feels like self-diminishment. We just become very small. And usually awe is associated with nature or art or some kind of beauty, another a person, inspiring person. Of course, we can have awe in the face of the Dharma. Yeah. That's a very beautiful place to practice from. It's very humble, but there's a lot of confidence. I remember early in practice, maybe the first year or two of practice, and I went to a weekend retreat with Galen Ferguson, who is in the Tibetan tradition, it was on the unity of tranquility and insight, and I was just so touched by the kind of generosity of his heart that I went up to him at the end of the retreat and was, you know, just I didn't even know what was going on exactly, but I was a mess, you know, I was just crying and, you know, like, what's happening to me? And he kind of like gently sort of probe to figure out what this whole situation was in front of him. Very, very sweet. And at some point he's kind of described like, oh yeah, you're kind of gazing into the vast ocean of Dharma. And that felt about right. It was just like, I could so acutely sense my own suffering, and I could sense the vastness of that ocean. And I had the intuition that, I might be swallowed up by that. I wasn't planning on this, but I might be swallowed up by that. And so a certain kind of intrinsic motivation takes over, this awe and this interest, and it becomes the kind of lifeblood of our practice. It is our kind of curiosity. It's far superior to discipline. Yeah. Discipline is, it's always a little fragile. But this interest is just kind of fuels this this seeking in this very wholesome way. And when a meditator comes to me and they're really just interested in their mind, I kind of find myself just relaxing. And because I do have a confidence, like, oh yeah, the path, that takes care of itself. Yeah, and we teachers, we prod and suggest and try to tease possibilities. We say things, we do our song and dance to try to spark intrinsic motivation. But ultimately, it's in your heart, right? That's by definition what makes it intrinsic and not extrinsic. Yeah. And so we find this in our own hearts, as Gil said, we will not find the path at IRC. We practice freely when we find the right rhythm of self-evaluation. Have you, just as a poll, have you ever judged your practice or felt dissatisfied with your mind? We don't have the poll function set up on Zoom. You can do that, a pop-up poll. That's not a request, Yanli. Bless your heart. But we know the answer to that poll, yeah? So what are we to make of that? What are we to make of that? The kind of perennial experience of kind of self-evaluation. And, you know, when I was doing, before I was doing Dharma stuff full time, I was in clinical research and we were doing clinical trials around medicine to help with addiction. And in those trials, we would assess people 3 times a week. Yeah, folks would come into the clinic to be assessed, see how people are doing. And the question, like, what is the right cadence for assessing your own practice? I don't know if it's true, but the Dalai Lama reportedly said, assess your practice maybe every 5 or 10 years. Yeah, that was the suggestion. Like, yeah, take a good hard look every 5 or 10 years. I don't know if that's true. Maybe it's exaggerated, but just that thought really can help us relax. Yeah. Because there is such a deep habit of trying to extract something from the moment, of being, of relating to the moment as if it's a transaction rather than something we offer our heart up to, as if we kind of, yeah, we extract something from the Dharma rather than surrender our heart to it. And so we know that kind of habit of we take one deep breath and then we kind of pop out and we ask the question, am I more concentrated? Yeah. Am I more free? And then we check and it's like, well, I don't know. Doesn't seem more free. Let me take another breath, right? Now? Yeah. And that habit of extracting value from the moment is a subtle kind of clinging. And so instead, we practice just again and again, surrendering to awareness. And it's not that the self-evaluations and the course correction doesn't happen. Like, it really does happen. There are times when it's like, oh yeah, we're building the road into the ditch or something like this. But those self-evaluations, my experience is that they happen very naturally, spontaneously. They feel like insights. They feel like we're putting together pieces of causality, but not in a kind of, there's no sense that we're compulsively checking in on ourselves. It's just like, a little too tight, a little too loose. And it arises as an insight very organically. We practice freely when we embrace the wholesome unpleasant. Yeah, the Buddha said that unpleasant can be wholesome or unwholesome. And there's pleasant, which can be wholesome or unwholesome. And that one corner in that little quadrant, you know, the wholesome unpleasant, that's an important quadrant, yeah, on this path. We develop a certain kind of reverence for the wholesome, unpleasant. This is a supportive attitude of mind. Because after all, this is a path of purification, meaning that we are weakening the forces of clinging within us by repeatedly exposing our hearts to that clinging and not acting out the dictates of the clinging. The impulse arises, do this, do that, don't do this, make this go away, make this happen. Speed that along, slow that down. All of the forces kind of arise, and we are willing to absorb the impact, the kind of body blow, mostly in the realm of feeling that comes when we do not act out the dictates of that compulsion. And over time, it's almost like the dictates become softer, more porous, less compelling. We habituate to this, and we're no longer spun in the same way, even if that energy arises. And in the cauldron of the practice, in the cauldron of one's heart, this is a special kind. This is for sure unpleasant, but it's a special kind of unpleasant. It hurts and it tastes like relief. Yeah. You can actually, one of my teachers, Shinzen Young, said, like, we develop a taste for purification. You can taste it, yeah, in your sensory system. It's like something, it hurts, and something is being metabolized, something consciousness is getting, is being freed up, energy is being freed up. So we develop this taste for purification. And at the same time, we respect the limits of our equanimity. To practice freely is not to insist on a level of equanimity we do not have. We work at the threshold of our tolerance. We play at the edges with this itch or that mood or this agitation or this heartbreak. We play at the edges, and we don't want to underestimate our heart's capacity to bear with our life. But we want to be careful about respecting the limits of our equanimity. We practice with patience. And so to let go is not to pry, not to pry open the clenched fist of clinging. The last piece we practice freely when we dedicate our practice to the welfare of others. Of course, it's natural, not just natural, it's beautiful to long to be free ourselves. That's a different kind of longing. That's not tanha. That's not craving. That's not, that's something different, that kind of heart longing. That's beautiful. And really even just to feel the depth of the longing to be free, just that, to really feel it, can break our hearts open. And the self always gets complicated. And so sometimes it's important to very, very actively sense all the ways that your own efforts, your own practice might be of benefit to those in your life, those close, those far. And at some points in practice, it's even hard to, there have been times in my own practice where I really just could not motivate to practice for myself. It was just like an intention I just couldn't really connect with. It had no sense of urgency. It's like, okay, I'm happy enough. But to practice for others, that's a skillful attitude of mind. Yeah, to know, okay, my delusion impacts others, my love impacts others. I remember sometimes early in practice, and I was sitting retreats, and just really just excruciating physical pain, kind of agony, sort of from the moment I would sit down, there would be pain, a lot of pain, to the moment I got up. And I can remember some of those practice periods where, yeah, it was like the only way I could get through it, the only kind of motivation that kept me going was the sense that, oh, something is being softened, and that will be of benefit to others. And that was the motivation that kept me on the cushion. So this opens a kind of a deeper faith in practice, that faith propels our practice forward. I was in... I've done very little Zen practice, but a little, and it was in Dokusan, an interview with a Zen teacher, and is not somebody I knew well, and he knew that I was not in, you know, I was practicing in the Vipassana world, and so wasn't trying to be heavy-handed at all, and anyway, so the Roshi asked me like why do I practice, and I said a few things, and then said, which was true, like I don't really know why I practice. And that he sort of took an interest in. Yeah. That he took an interest in. And he said something like, at some point it starts to feel less like you picked the Dharma and more like the Dharma picked you. Yeah, I don't know all the streams of karma bringing us to this moment. Yeah, but it's like maybe there's some sense like, yeah, the Dharma picked your heart. And then you just follow that thread. We usually think about practice as the means to an end, but here, much more like the means are the end. Let's just sit for a moment together. So thank you. I offer that for your consideration. So a couple announcements. For auditors, sign-ups with Inez have been posted for Wednesday through Saturday, and on the main retreat page. And just so as to ensure space for everyone who wants a slot, it's okay to sign up for a second time, but don't sign up on consecutive days, just to give spots for others. And tonight, for the full retreatants, Gil's doing, a 7 p.m. drop-in in question and answer. It's in the drop-in discussion room, and that's also posted on the retreat page. And so it's not in Gil's small group meeting room. It's in a dedicated different room. You'll see that link at the top of the document. Okay. It's nice to be with you. Let's keep going. Yeah, let's practice as freely as we can, knowing to some extent we must use the ladder of clinging and then put that aside as we grow and deepen in our freedom. Thank you.